Hello there, Na'ala Land. Today is Parshas Pinchas, and we begin by mentioning that this year is Lilin Shizrach Aleh Bas Chaim Tzvi Aleh Shalom. We thank Libby Bamja from the studio, all the Na'ala people. We begin our Parsha. Okay, we have in our Parsha the laws of Yichus, benefits of great lineage, both in a positive and in a negative way. It's very possible to compare, I think this was the verse of Shel Salanter. We say in Eish Yisrael, Sheker Achein Behevel HaYofi. Isha Yiras Hashem Hiti Salal. Sheker Achein. What is beauty? It's false. Hevel HaYofi. And prettiness, it's vanity. All things are nothing. You don't view them as zero. Zero, zero, zero. Isha Yiras Hashem. But if you have fear of heaven, it's like taking all these zeros and putting a one in front of it. The camera edge, putting one in front of it, then everything behind it has all that value. Beauty in and of itself is garnished, it's nothing. Prettiness in and of itself is nothing. Cuteness, all these things, but put one thing in front of it, then gives it value. Likewise, all this lineage is wonderful, but it's just a zero, zero, zero. But if you become important, then you have all these important generations behind you, then you have great lineage to increase your own power. But if you yourself are a zero, the Mr. Guru Grace Gornish, you're just a zero, then all those behind you, those zeros don't help you. It says you have to be a digit to make the ones behind you be a value. So now we have the inside story of Pinchas the Zealot. What happened is that Bnei Yisrael reached the lush plains of Moab. And there's a beautiful oasis, and that's really very beautiful after the very humid desert they had been in for the last 40 years. They had taken a rest, they're feeling good, they're calm, the weather's balmy for once. And then the Moabites, which are descendants of Lot was the nephew of Avram, and the wicked Midianites take advantage of the situation, and they realize that the Jewish people, their guard will be down. Now is the time to attack. And now is the time to implement the plan that Bilaam has given us. The plan is the plan of Bilaam. This is in the 31st chapter, to entice the Jews to sin. And this is what Bilaam said. Their God is a moral God. If you get the Jews to be immoral, then God will dispose of them himself. So how did the Moabites get the Jewish people to stumble? This is what they did. The people of Moab took their choicest beauties, and they were led by a Midianite princess, and their job was to seduce the Jewish men into sin. They would set up tents right by the corner of the camp of the Jews. They'd set up their camps, and they would sell precious linen and garments that the Jews were accustomed to getting from Egypt. Outside the tents were old ladies who would sell these garments at very expensive prices. But inside were these beauties who sold them for worse billig, for next to nothing. And these women were dressed to kill. And they're selling this merchandise, the very same merchandise, at a bargain. Outside you have the old woman. Inside you have it for cheap by these beautiful women who are dressed to kill. And we have to bear in mind the following. There are two ways you can violate the total prohibition against idolatry. How do you violate the Torah prohibition of idol worship? One of two ways. Either by performing in front of an idol any of the acts normally done in the Holy Temple. What was the avodah in the temple? There were sacrifices, there were libations, there were incense, bowing down. That's one way. Any kind of avodah, any of the service that was done in the temple, and you perform this service in front of an idol, that is a Torah prohibition of engaging in idolatry. The other way of engaging in idolatry is by doing any of the acts which is a normal way for the idol to be worshipped. Even if it's crazy, disgusting, appalling, but if this is the way that this avodah zarah, this idolatry is worshipped, and you do that worship, that will be another way of being violating the Torah Act prohibition of idolatry. For example, Marcellus was worshipped by throwing rocks at this tree. He threw rocks at it, that was a service. So if you were to throw rocks, then that would be the violation. Baal Peor, extremely appalling avodah zarah. And the way you worship this avodah zarah is by defecating to it. I didn't make that up. If you defecate to this, then you have worship Baal Peor. And you have to wonder, who in the world would want to find this avodah zarah of defecating? So Rav David Hirschmeyer Zatzal once said, such an insight, he said, you open up these magazines of bathroom decor. You see, the Slutnach, there it is, it's still there. People are still going into... wanted to outfit their bathrooms with every plush kind of mirror, which is so anti-tsnius, and so many other fancy, lazy things. Bapur, which sounds so weird, is still around, still in our day. All right, so if you want to definitely even go back to nature, have no shame. That's the other way of violating this prohibition. Okay, so what happened? How did they seduce the Jewish men? First, these Midianite beauties would offered the Jewish men a cup of wine. This is before the prohibition of the rabbis. You're not allowed to drink wine from a non-Jew. They'd give them a cup of wine. The Jewish men would get tipsy. And then they offered them their bodies on condition that they defecate before Baal Peor. And the Jewish men gladly did this. So Rabbi Avigdor Miller points out that the Jewish men didn't realize that this constituted idolatry. They figured like this: let's just humor these beauties. We'll go along with their silly idol. In the end, we'll show them beauty of Torah, and then we'll convert them, and we'll be able to marry them. That was their plan. But when many of the men gave in to the temptation, then the idolatry began to spread among the Jewish people. And then once they committed idolatry, God is going to avenge the Jewish people with his justice. And there's going to be tremendous punishment for this. Now, there are no police squads in the Torah system to catch lawbreakers. But if two adult males witness a crime, they have a witness to, they have an obligation to give the witness warning and tell him he's going to be brought to justice. And if the people who witness a crime don't give warning that the people will be punished for having committed the crime, that brings about God's anger, and God's anger will then be evoked upon the entire Jewish nation. So what happened was the courts began to hang up. We only do hanging, according to Jehoiada, after someone's already been put to death. Some of the wrongdoers, mostly from the tribe of Shimon, but the plague of death has already begun. At this point, when Shimon saw that it's losing its men, they ran to Zimri, who was their prince, and Zimri felt he had to make a stand. Now, what happened was is that a Midianite princess was brought to Zimri. Medrash says that she had first tried with no one less than Moshe Rabbeinu. Obviously, with Moshe, she was not successful. She now goes to Shimon, to the tribe of Shimon, to Zimri, who is the prince of Shimon, and she makes her advances to him. Zimri asked, "Is she permitted? Moshe, tell me, can I be with this princess from of the Midianite nation?" Moshe Rabbeinu said, "Of course you're not allowed to be with a non-Jewish woman." So then he says back to him, "Hold on, hold on. One second here. What about Tzipora? Your wife, Moshe, Rebbetzin Moshe. She's a Midianite. She comes from Midian. How is she permitted to become your wife?" And then, brazenly, in front of everyone, Zimri takes this princess in the tent in front of the entire nation. A public desecration, a horrific desecration of God's name. In front of everyone, Moshe and the elders begin to weep. Now, although having relations publicly with a non-Jew is not a capital offense, it is certainly a major mega moral sense. It is a treasonous act against the Jewish people. So we have a tradition that if someone is a zealot for the sake of God, for the sake of God, people are zealous for their own honor, but zealot for the sake of God, and you see an act of a desecration, then you may take justice into your own hands. So Pinchas, and we'll go into the Yichus in just a little moment, much more in depth, much, much more in depth. Pinchas was the grandson of Aaron, but he was not a Kohen because Aaron and his sons and the future progeny were only sanctified at a particular point in biblical history. At this point, Pinchas was excluded because he was not a grandson, not a son, and he's before the Kohanim had their assignment took effect. In other words, he wasn't born a Kohen. Aaron's sons and their progeny had not yet become Kohanim. So Pinchas, his Yichus, which will go back to Aaron, does not have effect yet because the next generations have not yet been pronounced as Kohanim. Pinchas is extremely upset and very perturbed to see Zimri's public debacle, and he asked Moshe Rabbeinu, "Have you not taught us the law?" To which Moshe replied, "The one who read the letter shall be the one who fulfills its orders." In other words, you realize that it's wrong, you go and act. He didn't waste any time. Pinchas took the blade of his spear from its shaft and he hid it under his cloak. Holding the shaft as one would be walking with a stick, he banged on the tent door, demanding his turn as well. "Come on, just you get to have her, I also want my chance." He comes inside, he quickly reassembles his spear. He impales Zimri and the Midianite princess at their point of connection. He then, with tremendous strength, able to lift them into the air, both of them together, and display them to the people outside the tent. I'm going to bring this in? Yes, okay. Now, this zealous act of Pinchas stopped the plague, which until this point had already claimed the life of 24,000 Jews. It was Pinchas' act of zealousy on behalf of God, genuinely acting on behalf of God, which brought about an end of this plague. So what is his reward? Now, the people were very, very upset at Pinchas, for Pinchas had killed a prince in Israel. And he felt he could justify his actions. And they began to make fun of Pinchas. They called him Pinchas. They called him Pinchas. They said, "You're not a descendant of the Jewish people." They poked fun of him. "You're descended from Yisro." Now, Yisro was a person who worshipped every single form of idolatry there was. So this proves to you don't have proper intentions. You're just an idol worshipper yourself. So I'm going to go at great length now to explain to you the use of Yisro. I hope I can maintain your attention. I'm sure I will. And this is all culled from the work of Eliyahu Kitov, one of the great authors, who passed away in 1976. Very, very acclaimed religious writer. And there's a lot of background over here, but we'll go through the Medrash, who explains who exactly was the Yichus of Pinchas. So this is what the Medrash says, and I'm going just culling from the translation of Eliyahu Kitov. When Pinchas killed Zimri, he did not consult with the sages nor with Moshe. He acted his act zealously on his own cognizance. His reaction was not received well by the people. He comes out holding, impaled aloft on the spear. The man and woman connected at the point of connection. There's people. So, those sympathetic followers of Peor, which was the Moabite idolatry, which is a very disgusting idolatry, they feared for their own lives as well. They said like this: if this is the fate of Zimri, who is so highly respected among the people, then what will be our fate? They're also going to stick us. We're finished. Now, the majority of the people, including those who were loyal to God, derided Pinchas for action, saying, they said, "Did you see this Ben Puti?" Now, Putio was one of the names of Yisro, who's an ancestor of Pinchas. So they're making fun of him. "Did you see this Ben Puti, who killed a prince in Israel, one of the elder princes?" And even the loyal followers of Moshe wondered. Pinchas could not be very God-fearing. After all, he defied our teacher Moshe by not consulting him. He acted as if he were the own teacher. They were ignorant of the fact that he went to Moshe. Moshe said, "You read the law, you remember the law." Moshe didn't remember it. "You remembered it, you act upon it." So he didn't consult with Moshe, he acted on his own. How could he do this? And they lose all their respect for Pinchas. Now, what's the Yichus? Pinchas was the son of Elazar, who was the son of Aaron HaKohen, who was not himself a priest. When Aaron and his sons were consecrated as priests, Pinchas was not included. So Pinchas performed his seemingly impetuous act, and this impetuous act had so much resentment among the people. How could you do this thing? You're not part of the family. You take a very distinguished person among the people, and you have him murdered. It became common to hear people say, "Now we understand why Pinchas was not designated to serve as a Kohen. Because why?" Who was his answer? Aaron the Kohen. "Oh, hey, shalom, bro, de shalom." Aaron was the person who always loved peace. When two people are having an argument, Aaron go to one side and said, "You know what this person said?" "What did he say?" "He said he feels terrible that he's hurt your feelings. He really wants to make up with you." He went to the other one. "You know what this person says?" "What does he say?" "He says he knows he's wrong. He knows he regrets it so much. He wishes only he could make up with you." And he was able to get everyone to come together. Aaron's attribute was that of peace. "Oh, hey, shalom, bro, de shalom." A lover of peace, a pursuer of peace. And who's this guy? He thinks he's a descendant of Aaron. Look at what he does. He goes and takes spears and punctures them. This is no descendant of Aaron. Now we know why he was not a descendant of Aaron. He doesn't have that loving kindness. Nor does he possess the stature of Elazar. Elazar, his father, he has a strange quality, an alien quality, the quality of quarrelsomeness. It must be comes from Midian. He's not from the Jewish people. His maternal grandfather was that of a priest of Midian. He comes from Yisro. Now, Pinchas' zealousness is not pure, done for the sake of heaven, they said. He is just a zealous person consumed with anger. And that's the reason, they said, why he was never made into a Kohen. Okay. So Yisro was the high priest of Midian. He was a very high advisor of the king of Midian. And because of his stature and because of his wisdom, which surpassed all the wise men in all of Egypt, Pharaoh also befriended Yisro. And this, of course, is that well-known Medrash we know, that when Pharaoh wanted to enslave the Jewish people, he convened a celestial kangaroo court. He subpoenaed to the court Yisro and Eov, and Bilaam. They said, what should I do to the Jews? Should I enslave them or not? So Bilaam said, that's a wonderful idea. So what was Bilaam's recompense? Bilaam got it in the neck. That's what happened to him. Yisro did not want to part of this travesty of justice. He knew that Paro's mind was made up. He was going to enslave the Jews anyways. So he just fled so as not to be part of this travesty of justice. And what about Eov? Eov said, what's the point? I know what he's going to do. And therefore he just remained quiet. What was the recompense? Bilaam got it in the neck. Yisro was zocha that his children sat in Lushal Gaza, that his children became the people, members of the Sanhedrin. And what happened to Eov? Horrible, unspeakable suffering. It says in Perek Tesin, Eov, the Medrash, that besides the fact he lost his wife and his children, his possessions, everything, an angel came and beat him to the point of death with a whip, then revived him, and then beat him again. He said he took a piece of shard of pottery and he was peeling off his flayed skin and he was sitting in a mound of his own flesh. Unbelievable suffering. Why is that? So Chaim Shulevitz would quote from the Brisker of all the time. Job is calling out his pain. And God says, why are you crying? Because the pain is so great, but your crying doesn't stop the pain, but it hurts. Said God, why didn't you cry out when Pharaoh wanted to enslave the Jews? He said, what's the point? He's going to do it anyways. See, if something cries, if something hurts you, you have to cry out. That's the way it is. If something hurts you, have to cry out. That's why, even though it seems a bit obnoxious when people yell out, Shabbos, Shabbos, when the cars are going by, if they're doing it for the proper zealous reason, that it really hurts them so much, if something hurts you, you cry. If it hurts you, you cry. Okay. So now, Yisro is the high priest of Midian, a very important advisor to the king of Midian, and because of his stature, and because of his wisdom, he's also befriended to Pharaoh, and he's a close counselor of Pharaoh, close counselor to the king of Midian, and a close counselor to Pharaoh, the king of Egypt. Now, Yisro's very compassionate advice is very often rejected by Pharaoh. Still, Pharaoh remains close to him, and throughout all of the palace of Pharaoh, Yisro is respected. Now, Yisro continues to travel between Midian and Egypt, which, whenever the opportunity presented itself, and that shows the high importance of the position between Egypt and Pharaoh in those days. Now, when Moshe flees Pharaoh because he has to flee for his life, this is after Moshe killed an Egyptian and he buried him, and then Dust and Beam are going to squeal on him. So Moshe flees for his life into the land of Midian, and he came to Yisro's house. Now, Yisro sees that here he is a person who's in hot pursuit by Pharaoh, and he hides Moshe in his house for years as the agent of Pharaoh trying to find this fugitive who's run away from Egyptian justice. And during this time, Yisro has harbored Moshe. He learns about Moshe's origins, about his family back in Egypt. He learns about how the people in Israel are crying out from their oppression and how they thirst for redemption. He learns from Moshe to recognize the one God of Israel, and he begins to reject the gods, all the false gods of Midian. So when Yisro goes to Egypt, he'd always seek out the family of Moshe. He would secretly visit Amram, who was the father of Moshe. He'd visit the other family members. And when Yisro sought to marry one of his daughters, one of his seven daughters, because of his great respect for the Jewish people, he is determined to marry a member of this nation, descendants of Avram, of Yitzchak, of Yaakov, who are now subjugated by Pharaoh, the king of Egypt. And who is he selected to be his son-in-law? Of course, Moshe Rabbeinu. As his future son-in-law, Yisro chose one of the descendants of that family, of the fabled Yosef. Yisro's daughter gave birth to a female child, who eventually married Elazar, the son of Aaron. But the people of Israel began to ridicule Aaron for accepting a Midianite wife for his son, Elazar. But despite this ridicule, Elazar and Yisro's granddaughter marry, and they have a child whom they call by the Egyptian name of Pinchas. So again, Aaron marries a Midianite woman, and they have a son, Elazar. Let's get this right one more time. I'm sorry. Yisro's daughter gives birth to a female child. Now, this is going to be, this granddaughter is a granddaughter to Yisro, who marries Elazar, the son of Aaron. So that means that Elazar is a mechutin with Yisro. And then people begin to ridicule Aaron for accepting a Midianite woman for his wife, for his son Elazar. That Aaron allowed his son Elazar to marry a woman from Midian. Despite this ridicule, Elazar and Yisro's granddaughter marry and they have a child, whom they call by the Egyptian name of Pinchas. Now, as his future son-in-law, Yisro chose one of the descendants of that family of the fabled Yosef. That we said already. Now, people view this child as an alien individual. He's not appropriate in the Jewish vineyard. We don't want someone who is not from Jewish people, this Midianite influenced person. And they say his mother's Midianite and he himself is an Egyptian. So here, Pinchas from the very beginning, they called him Pinchas. They said, listen, his lineage is not of the Jewish people. On the mother's side, he is a Midianite, and from the father's side, he's coming from Egypt, not a Jew. So when Pinchas did his act of zealotry, people got his case all over again. So listen here, he doesn't come from noble stock, he's a Midianite, he's an Egyptian, he's a son of Puti, and he killed an exalted prince of the Jewish people. Obviously he's not a Kohen, he's not worthy of being a Kohen. His mother's a convert, who's not allowed to marry a Kohen. And that's why he was never made a Kohen to begin with. And he's never going to be able to achieve atonement for the people of Israel. You think what he did was zealousness that God should forgive us? On the contrary, nothing legitimate at all. He's a person who, instead of bringing an end to God's wrath, he will increase God's jealousy and anger and bring God's wrath upon the Jewish people. Therefore, people were taken aback when God announced to Moshe that Pinchas, the son of Elazar, the son of Aaron of Kohen, has turned back my wrath from the children of Israel, because he has zealously avenged me among them, so I have not consumed the children of Israel with my vengeance, and therefore I give to him my covenant of peace. Remarkable. Here's a person that everyone was mocking, saying he's not from our people, and God himself affirms the fact. And through this act of zealously, you think it's a wanton act of violence. On the contrary, that's what brings about peace. And we have to strive for peace. We'll come to that in just a moment. It doesn't matter what the people think. The Almighty is the one who sees the inner essence of the human being and changed the name. That one letter, the Yud, the name of God himself, it comes from Pinchas, it becomes Pinchas. No longer will he be called Pinchas the Egyptian. From now on, he's Pinchas, the son of Elazar, the son of Aaron of Kohen. He's not an Egyptian. He's not the son of a Midianite. He's not the son of a convert. But he's Pinchas, the son of Elazar. The mother was not a convert. She was the daughter of a convert. And she was permitted to marry Kohen. Moreover, before the giving of the Torah, everyone was regarded as a convert. So you called him derisively Ben Putiel, as if to say that his maternal grandfather, Yisro, was the one who did all kinds of idolatry. I say this is a badge of honor. Because what is it, Ben Putiel? It's really referring to Bayit B'Yitzro, referring to Yosef. Yosef is the one who was able to fight against his Yetzer in Bas Potiphera, and fighting against his evil inclination, is able to overcome that. This is what the name refers to. Everything about him is commendable. He's worthy of being a priest, not only because he comes from descendants of priests, but he himself is like Aaron of Kohen. Pinchas, like Aaron, his grandfather, was able to turn back the anger of the anger of God, and achieve atonement for the entire Jewish people. He's now a member of the covenant of peace, and that will keep the entire world together. So, the rabbis have taught us that a person can only lead the Jewish people if he has the consent of the entire people. So what happened? So we now see that God appointed Pinchas to serve as a Kohen among all the people. So the people were not willing to accept Pinchas. They felt that he should not be the one to bring sacrifices in the temple. They don't want to let him go there. They're not going to bring him to the tabernacle. But what happens is that 15 years later, after the capture and division of the land of Canaan, Pinchas was allowed to serve as a Kohen. What happened? So now we refer to the book of Joshua. That after the capture and division of the land, three tribes of Bnei Israel, which means Reuven, Gad, and half the tribe of Manasseh, they settle on the eastern bank of the Yarden, or the eastern bank of the Jordan River, and they returned to their homes and built an altar on the banks of the Yarden in order to sacrifice to God. Now, this did not sit well with the other nine and a half tribes. What right do they have to bring an altar on the other side of the Yarden? They have no right to do this. It's a gross violation. It doesn't sit well with them. And we see in the 22nd chapter of Joshua, people are gathering an army and they're ready to go to war over this. That those Reuven, Gad, and Chatzi Shevet Menashe, they could offer up an altar on the other side of the Yarden, which is not sanctioned, it's not authorized. They're prepared to go to war. What happens? Prior to the attack, Pinchas, the son of Elazar the priest, along with 10 princes of the tribes, were sent across the Yarden to negotiate with the rebels. And Pinchas was a spokesman. He reproved these tribes for doing that which they should not be doing, and the tribes backed off, and they agreed not, they're not going to use the altar. So now when Pinchas comes back, they have a Yarden back with the other 9.5 tribes, and the people acknowledge how effective Pinchas was, and it was able to restore peace among the different tribes, then everyone accepts him unanimously as to serve as a Kohen and begin to serve in the tabernacle. And he merits longevity, serving for many, many years. Okay. Hatkan, I hope we found that. It's the Yichus of Pinchas. Okay, now zealotry is only permitted when it's performed without any ulterior motives. As long as you're doing it for your own aggrandizement, for your own pride, then it's forbidden. It's only if you're totally divorced from the act. You're acting only on behalf of God. Some people claim that Pinchas was biased due to the fact that his mother's lineage was from Midian. So God proclaims very, very obviously to the contrary. It was the act of Pinchas' lineage from Aaron, who loved peace and pursued peace, not done with any ulterior motives. Sometimes you have to fight for peace. That's the great lesson. If you want to be like Neville Chamberlain, and you're going to say peace in our time, because if you give to a dictator, you get more dictation. The Munich Conference in 1938, in the autumn of 1938, was an example of trying to avoid war. So they give away to Hitler, and that brings about World War II. And because of that, 55 million people were killed. Families destroyed. Not to mention the Holocaust of the Jews. Just we have 55 million people, all because they're going to pursue. There are times you have to fight, and that will maintain the peace. You can't just always passivity. So Pinchas is given the covenant of peace. And his descendants into the priesthood forever. He becomes a Kohen, eventually the high priest. Now, according to tradition, Pinchas lived for many, many years. And he's identified with Eliyahu HaNavi, who prophesied the time of the Jewish kings. And Eliyahu HaNavi went to heaven in a chariot, and he will announce the coming of Mashiach, who will bring peace to the world forever. So let's just pause for a moment and talk about the peace. Again, who was the one who brought peace? We know the Aaron HaKohen, we know his role. He was a person who loved peace and pursued peace. Oy Shalom, Brother Shalom. Because peace is something which you can't just do from an armchair. You have to be actively, proactively involved in trying to pursue peace. That's certainly what Aaron did. He's able to bring together husband and wife that were distanced, partners that were distanced, neighbors that were distanced. He's able to bring them together. He'd tell one person one story, another person another story. He'd bring them together. That's the ways of Aaron HaKohen. In our time, other methods we've spoken about on a different occasion, I can just suggest a few ideas. One is what the Chafetz Chaim writes, where he writes and it's just buried in Rumi's essays. How do you pursue peace? So he says the following. He says, if you have an argument with someone, you're right, and the other person is wrong. Isn't it amazing how often this happens? One more time. You're right, the other person is wrong. What should you do? You do. Says the Chafetz Chaim, you should give in, tell God the problem, explain the situation, he'll take care of it. He gives the following analogy. Father's giving supper to his children, gives everyone an eighth of chicken, America, a quarter of chicken. And Beryl takes Shmerel's piece of chicken in front of all his siblings, in front of Perel, in front of Cheryl. So what does Shmerel do? He's a clever boy, goes to his father, says, one of my siblings took my supper. Now we all know how it is, my piece of chicken. Now my piece of chicken, we all know it, especially if you're a parent, grease and bones and fighting. At this point, you're not interested in justice, give everyone a patch and tell everyone to be quiet. However, says the Chafetz Chaim, what you do is give in, tell God the problem, explain the situation. Our Father above will give you doubles. Because he loves when we're together, and he despises when you argue. So if you give in, even if you're right, you're going to end up getting double. It may not seem like macho, but it's the most noble thing you can do is give in to avoid an argument. That's one step towards peace. Another step towards peace is that there is a prohibition in the Torah, lo tatayiv mitzri ki ger hayita barzo. You're not allowed to hate an Egyptian because you were once strangers in their land. Now, one second here. What about the fact they tried to afflict and torture, and they gave us so many years of slavery? Are we allowed to remember this? Of course. There's a mitzvah from the Torah to remember every day how we suffered in Egypt. What about to tell over the story? Of course, there's a mitzvah from the Torah once a year to tell over the story. But may you hate them? You may not. Because when we were desperate, they provided a roof over our heads. And here's a real simple lesson. If you're not allowed to hate an Egyptian who persecuted and tortured and afflicted, how much more so should you not hate a neighbor, a stranger, a friend who doesn't do you a favor? It is human nature. If you ask someone for a favor and they refuse to grant you the favor, you're all angry and frustrated. But the fact of the matter is they don't owe you anything. Instead of thinking about the bad, think about the good. How many times they did you a favor? And this time they didn't, even if it's abrupt and you think, why couldn't they do me a favor? And I work on myself very much in this way. Person doesn't owe you anything. If you ask them a favor, they say no. Don't think about this. Think about how many times they did you a favor. If you're not allowed to hate an Egyptian who afflicted and tortured, how much more should you not despise someone who doesn't do you a favor? Another step towards peace is the famous Gemara in Ksubas. The Gemara says in Tazayin Mavais, Ketzem Merakfneka, how do you dance before the bride? Beishamai, Rashi explains, what do you say? Ma'omin lefaneha, what do you say? As I understand it, not like today, you have these long, protracted courtships, 2 dates, 3 dates, you know, get married. No, in those days, what happened was, they meet each other, they get married right away. She goes down to the chuppah, he's marching down to the chuppah, and then she's coming, he's thinking to himself, what have I done to myself? So Mary wants to know, how are you going to assuage the groom, his frazzled nerves? What should you do? Beishamai omrim, you tell it exactly the way it is. Kala kamochi, if she's beautiful, you say beautiful. She looks like the back of a naked bus, say like the back. You say, tell it exactly the way it is. Ask Beis Hillel, how can you warrant, how can you do such a thing? How can you say exactly the way it is? What if it should be horrifically? How can you say something which is going to, Beishamai says, no matter what you say, tell it like it is. Beautiful, beautiful, ugly, ugly. Says Beis Hillel, no matter what you say, Kala no vichas, no matter what you say that she is a beautiful and a gracious bride. Ask Beishamai, how can you warrant? How can you license saying beautiful and gracious if she be objectively ugly, horrifically, ichsa pichsa? It says in the Torah, you have to avoid speaking fools. Answers Beis Hillel Beishamai, such a great Gemara. How do you answer a question? With a question. Let me ask you a question. One who buys a bad purchase, you should you praise it? Should you extol it? Or should you denigrate it? Obviously, someone buys a bad purchase. When they say, it's too late now, you tell them it's terrible, you're a fool. Say, nice thing. Maybe next time you go buy something like this, take me along. But you don't make them feel bad. It's done already. He's already standing under the chuppah. She's marching down. What are you going to say? It's a bad, bad, bad kala? And the Gemara's fabulous conclusion is, from here the rabbis have derived that whatever you say should be pleasing to the creations, not hurtful, not gratuitous, not spiteful, but pleasing. Always put in a good word. There's no reason. People are always, people ask you a question. They're fishing for a compliment. How do I look? Blah! They're not asking for practical reasons. The taxi's honking. They're going outside for the date. How do I look? Say something gracious. What you say should be pleasing to the creations, not hurtful, not gratuitous, not spiteful. And we can add on, also the Chafetz Chaim writes, it is a very wise idea to set up a peace fund, a Keren Shalom. What's a peace fund? You have money in your pocket allocated for peace. There are so many arguments that could be avoided through money. And this way, the next time you're about to get in an argument with someone, just take the money out of the peace plan, don't get into argument. You can ask your Shiloh if you can take this off of Meiser, but it's not like it's coming out of your pocket. You already allocated from the beginning of the year. This money is set aside for peace. And that way, you avoid an argument. Okay, a few tips about how to avoid argument, and we'll end off with one last very important one, most important of all, is to give the benefit of the doubt, to judge favorably. And this is a challenge all the time, to see the good and not the bad. And when you see something which looks very strange, the policy we've adopted in my family is, you look out the window, and you see someone doing something strange, we always say chapter 3. We just didn't read the first two chapters, we came in the middle. If you're cultured, you can say Act 2, the idea is the same. You think you know, but you miss one detail, and you miss the whole story. Time and again, more often than not, when you judge favorably, you judge correctly. Okay, so the end of our parsha is the second census. After this plague, which Pinchas brings an end to, a second census is taken. So the first census was taken 40 years earlier, at the beginning of going into the wilderness, and this is now at the end of the wilderness. When a shepherd returns his flock, he counts them again. So before the demise of Moshe Rabbeinu, a second census is in order, and a second census is indicated. Every single family is mentioned with the letter He in the beginning and Yud at the end. These are the letters Yud and He of God's name. It's He in the beginning and Yud at the end. And they are testifying that they are their father's children and not the Egyptians, because the Egyptians would slander them, saying that they were their fathers. Those, these women, they conceived from us Egyptians. So God testifies with his own name, no. These are holy children, they belong to their fathers. The He symbolizes women, comes before the Yud, which symbolizes men, to demonstrate that in the merit of the righteous woman were the Jews redeemed from Egypt. Now we talk about the inheritance of the land. There's a very unusual method that was employed to divide the land according to the size of each tribe. That's the first thing it says in the Pasuk. That's in 26, chapter 54. And then it says in chapter 50, in verse 56, by the mouth of the lottery shall the inheritance be divided. So here's a question. If you're going to divide the land according to lotteries, how can you have the line divided evenly? Some tribes are very populous. Some are not so populous. So how is that going to be divided evenly? Because if you're drawing lots, the smaller tribe may end up drawing the larger portion, or vice versa. So how can you divide each one according to the size of the tribe? The answer is that this was the procedure. In order to prevent any complaints, right? People said, I want this land over here, and I want it over here, and I want it in the fertile area. That the land was divided into 12 sections approximately of equal value, some larger and some were smaller in size. The 12 portions were inscribed on 12 lots, and the names of 12 tribes on 12 other lots. So then the Kohen Gadol would look at his breastplate and announce that this tribe gets this portion. Then the prince of each tribe would then proceed to pick exactly the lot of his tribe and the aforementioned portion. And that's literally what the verse says, that the lottery itself would call out, I'm for this tribe, by the mouth of the lottery. In other words, there was no controversy in how the lands were. They'd look at the breastplate, it would say, this tribe for this plot of land, then they'd pick out the lottery, and the lottery confirmed what it said, and that's really the lottery itself, with no contention whatsoever, no argumentation, everybody got their appropriate plot of land. And we conclude our parsha with the story of the daughters of Tzlafchad. Here's one more law that was emitted by Moshe Rabbeinu, so that another Jew would have the merit of teaching it to the people. Now, Tzlafchad, according to some, was the one who desecrated the Shabbos, who got the death penalty. We learned that in Parsha Shlach. He had 5 daughters, but no sons. The daughters asked Moshe Rabbeinu, if girls are considered to be the children equal to boys, why then can't we receive our father's portion of the land of Israel? This was no demonstration for women's liberation. There's no feminism here. What they wanted to know is, there are no sons. So we know if there'd be sons, the boys would have the first right to inherit. They only asked the question in case where there are no sons, and they didn't want their inheritance to be lost. They wanted to be able themselves, they were zealous to have a portion in the land of Israel. So God concerned himself with the daughter's request. And from then on, the law was established that whenever a man dies without sons, then the daughters inherit from their father. But you have to realize that up until the Western modern world, it was unheard of ever that women would inherit land. These women zealously wanted a portion of the land of Israel, and because they were so zealous to have one, they may ended up receiving it. And with this, I will conclude our parsha. We'll meet again next week in Rosh Hashanah.